Okay, so the existence of isomers, which is what Wohler discussed in this paper about urea, had great import for the development of organic chemistry because it showed there was more than analysis, more than composition to what matter was. That there must be something that we would now call structure, something about the arrangement of the pieces that could make isomers different from one another in their properties. So composition is what elements are there and in what weight ratios, or if you follow Dalton, what atomic ratios. Okay? But there are three other C's that have to do with structure. One is constitution. Constitution means what bonds are there, which atoms are linked together, right? Configuration has to do with how they're arranged in space. That seems curious to you, I suspect, that you'd think that how things are linked together has to do with their arrangement in space. But you'll see later on that for these people, that those were two distinct questions, what was bonded to what and how things were arranged in space, especially three-dimensional space. And finally, conformation. But it's going to take us a while to get through all these, most of the 19th century. In fact, into the mid-20th century before we really handle conformation properly. So you got to be patient. Pardon me?
What is
conformation? Conformation has to do, again, with the arrangement in space. It has to do with rotation about bonds rather than just with what is bonded. But we'll get there. Be patient, as I say. Okay, now we talked early on in the course about drawing Lewis structures for isomers of HNCO, right? And a few years ago, Alan tried to calculate as accurately as he could the energy for all these things using very high-level quantum mechanics. And this is what he found. That with C in the middle, that's cyanate. And you could put H on one end or H on the other end. But these are both acids, cyanic acid and I suppose isocyanic acid. I'm actually not sure of the name of the other one. So the proton can come off one end and go back on the other end quite easily. So they interconvert very rapidly. And one of them is, 24 kilocalories more stable than the other. So it dominates dramatically at equilibrium. Okay, but if you put nitrogen in the middle, you get either this isomer with the hydrogen on the carbon or this isomer with the hydrogen on the oxygen. And those, again, would rapidly interconvert because they form the same anion. Those ones at the one at the bottom, is called cyanic acid. And that's the one that Wohler was trying to make the ammonium salt of when he made urea. But at the same time, Liebig was working on fulminic acid. There's a story that he was apprenticed to a pharmacist and fiddled around and he saw a traveling demonstrator or something making explosions with fulminic acid. So he tried it himself in the pharmacy and blew the window out and lost his job. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But anyhow, fulmin is the Latin word for lightning. So that this stuff you see has a lot more energy than cyanic acid, so it explodes. Silver fulminate is a very dangerous explosive. There's stories I could tell you about that too, but we don't have time. But anyhow, Liebig was interested in fulminic acid. So what did he do? He analyzed it, right? Here he is. This is a fairly early picture, but not as early as when in 1824, at the age of 21, he was in Paris working on silver fulminate with Gay-Lussac. And, of course, he analyzed it. And what Gay-Lussac noticed was that the analysis was just the same as Wohler's analysis of silver cyanate. So the silver fulminate and silver cyanate were then isomers. And in fact, this is what Wohler referred to in his paper about urea, that the cyanates and fulminates had the same, were isomers of one another, had the same analysis. Although the name isomer didn't come for another year or two when Berzelius thought it up. So here's a picture of Liebig, who was one of the principal chemists of the 19th century. And remember, these pictures almost always have some device in them. And this has this weird device, which you might think is some sort of alchemical symbol or something like that. But in fact, it's the most important device of the 19th century for organic chemistry. This was to 19th century organic chemistry what scanning probe microscopy and NMR and everything else is to our current chemistry. It was the technique, the instrument that allowed them to do forefront research. And it was invented by Lavoisier. In fact, do you recognize this? Right? What do you notice? Right? Or if you go into the library in this building, you'll see this wood carving. Right? Or if you join the American Chemical Society, it'll be on your membership card. It's the logo. And you will know something that very few people... I once asked the president of the American Chemical Society if he knew what that was, and he said no. Okay? Okay? So here's a picture from a paper by Liebig in 1831 about his improvement of the way to do elemental analysis. So at first glance, it looks very much like what Betzelius did. You have this tube that's packed with the stuff that's going to get burned, so you're going to have combustion and the gases will come out. And you have a tube of calcium chloride that collects water, so you weigh that before and after to see how much hydrogen. But now he's got this different device, this so-called five-bulb apparatus, or Fünf-Kugel apparat, or Kali apparat. There's a web page about it you can read if you want to. And this is then what became the badge of honor of organic chemists throughout the 19th century after this time in 1831 when Liebig invented it. And he improved it over the years as well. You see that there's a... So this is the thing that's going to replace... Remember how did Betzelius collect CO2, you remember? And weigh it. Brian? Pardon me? And where was it? Where was the potassium hydroxide? How did he have it? No. It was in a bulb that was floating on mercury, and you bubbled the oxygen and the CO2 in there, and it was tied with glove leather, and you had to wait 12 hours after the mercury stopped. So it was very, very slow, tedious process. But this was so much easier that you could teach a student to do it, and they could do 3 or 4 analyses a day. Enormous difference from having a really expert person spend several days to do an analysis. So this made a really big difference, and analysis was the main tool, quantitative tool, that people had in the 19th century. Now there's some subtleties about this. Like, you'll notice that it's tilted. There's a wedge underneath it there. Right? And he made a subsequent improvement shown in this one, where this is from 1837, where now what do you notice about those two bulbs at top? Yeah, their sizes are different, which wasn't true in the previous one. And notice it's cushioned. Now, why does it need to be cushioned? Because you're going to weigh this before and after, so you don't want just to be weighing glass to have something that weighs 5 pounds and you're going to be measuring a change of a gram in it or something like that. You want it to be as light and as small as possible. So it was made out of fairly thin glass, right? So you didn't want to have extra glass there if you could, so they had to cushion it so it would not break. Now here's an example of a lecture demonstration, one that I had made. So it's not made out of thin glass, but it has the same, it's got the five bulbs. Now, so this is Kali, potassium hydroxide, and actually it's water in there, but in his it would be potassium hydroxide to absorb the CO2. Now, remember Lavoisier had a guy sitting there stirring those two things and so on, but notice this one is self-stirring. Actually, as shown here, it doesn't work right. Watch what happens if I blow into it. So a lot of the gas just blows straight across, right? You want it to mix itself as it goes. So remember what he did? He tilted it like this, right? And now watch. So each bulb has a bubble come up and it stirs itself as it goes, right? It's important that it be tilted. Now, why are the bulbs different size? Why are the bulbs up here all together? They don't have any solution in them. Why do you have those bulbs? Why don't you just need these three? Yeah. This stuff could blow right out, right? This traps the extra stuff that comes in. Okay, but why do you need this one? Remember, you don't want any extra weight there, unnecessary weight. Why do you have this one? Yeah. Okay. What happens at the end? At the end, you put the fire out under here, and then what will happen when this cools off on the left? It'll suck back. Now watch. Why is it bigger on your right?
Because it's tilted.
Because when it's tilted, much more of the solution will come this way than can go that way. Everybody see that? When it's going that way, very little solution gets into the bulb. But when you're going this way, you have to take a lot of solution. So there were a lot of subtle things so this thing is deceptively simple. Right, but it really worked. So here's an example in Liebig's laboratory in Gießen in Germany, where he did this. And there's the thing. Although it's set up wrong, right? It's not tilted, right? But at least it's right that it has the big one here, so the gas will come in and then go out through a smaller bulb. Okay. Now here is a photographic portrait of Liebig taken in 1852, and as in the paintings, you see they have his apparatus. Here's the oven that heats up, and the gas comes out here and into the five bulb apparatus. But do you notice anything interesting? Imagine how many students he had to tell over the years, right? This is 21 years after he invented the thing. Imagine how, you know, like people, your TA comes to you and say you have your condenser hooked up backwards. You know, the water's supposed to go in the bottom and out the top, right? They have to that doesn't come intuitively, right? You have to learn that, okay? But the same thing would be true here as to which way you hook up the five bulb apparatus. But look at this. It's hooked up backwards in his portrait. How could he possibly have allowed that? He must have told hundreds of students about that in his time. Because he was the guy that had the idea of having teaching laboratories where you get a bunch of students to come in and do lab work. So if you want to blame somebody, blame Liebig, right? So students came from all over the world, in particular from America to do this. So here's the laboratory in Gießen where he held out. And here are his scientific descendants. This is a list that was made in 1967, which is on display in that museum. And all the ones that are in red are people that got the Nobel Prize, which looks surprising, but it isn't, because practically everyone is descended from Liebig. So you, for example, are descended from Liebig through T.W. Richards, who was an American, right? But he was fabulously influential because of teaching people how to use this five bulb apparatus. And here's a picture of students in his lab at that time. On the left here is Vicente Ortigosa from Mexico, who was the first important chemist in Mexico. And notice what he's holding. He's the guy, of all the people in the picture, he's the only one that gets to hold the potash apparatus, the five bulb apparatus. And you notice how he's holding it? Upside down, so the potash would get on his coat there if he had any in there. I don't know. There's another picture. It's the same picture, but it's a drawing instead of a painting, where he's holding it right side up. I just think that's interesting. Okay, and on the right is A.W. Hoffmann, who was a native of Gießen, as you can see here, born in Gießen. It says, a master and glittering teacher of chemistry, the triumphant discoverer of aniline and the aniline dyes, which was the first big commercial triumph of organic chemistry, was being able to make new dyes. So he studied, obviously. He was a native of Giessen and studied, and then went on to London and to Berlin. Here's an interesting thing in this little cabinet at the back, and it's hard to know exactly what it is, but it might be this, which is a bust of Liebig. So you remember, you're related to him, as is everybody else. Okay, so then in 1832, so that was an important experimental development, but the theoretical development that followed was radical theory. Now remember that Lavoisier had already talked about radicals, even compound radicals. Radicals were the roots of things that got oxidized. It was, for Lavoisier, synonymous with base, the thing that reacted with oxygen to give an acid. Yeah. The name of what?
The name of that five-bulb.
That's what it's called. The Fünf-Kugel-Apparat, the five-bulb apparatus. Or the Kali, K-A-L-I, apparat. And if you want to read more about it, look at the webpage. There's interesting stuff there about that, I think. Okay, so, but the radical theory got a big boost forward in 1832 on the basis of interaction between Wöhler and Liebig. There are two volumes of correspondence between Wöhler and Liebig. This is volume one, which is very interesting. They were the two leading organic chemists of the middle of the 19th century, especially the second quarter. They met in the winter of 1825, having been put in touch by Gay-Lussac, who noticed that they worked on isomers, and they met in Frankfurt. And by 5 years later, they were writing to one another, as you can read in here, and began to use do, you know, the familiar, like to in French and Spanish and so on. So they were good friends. Although they were of quite different temperaments, Wöhler, remember, liked to make puns and draw cartoons and so on. It was very funny. Whereas Liebig was a very sort of straight-laced guy that liked to get into arguments. But they were really good friends of one another. So in 16 May 1832, Wöhler wrote and said, "I long to do some more significant work. Shouldn't we try to shed some light on the confusion about the oil of bitter almonds? But where to get material? Nowadays, you can just buy the oil of bitter almonds." Can you smell that? Notice the smell? Do you notice the smell? I get a little bit more. What I don't want it to do is leak out on you.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, see if there's enough there to smell. Just pass it around, but just tighten the top a little bit. Okay. Now you can buy it. Then you couldn't. Where do you suppose you got it? From almonds, right? Okay, so, but then, this was May, a month later, Liebig writes to Wöhler. Wöhler had just gone from Berlin to Kassel to be a professor, and his bride, whom he had married in Berlin, had just died in June. And Liebig wrote to him saying, "My poor dear Wöhler, how empty is every comfort against such a loss. When I think how content and happy you were during your move, what attachment and love you had for one another, the good wife so young and full of life, so irreplaceable for her parents and for you. Come to us, dear Wöhler. Although we may not be able to give you comfort, we will perhaps be able to help you bear your grief. Staying in Kassel at this time would only be detrimental to your health. We need to be busy with something. I've just been able to get some amygdalin from Paris." Amygdalin is the ground up almonds, okay? Or is stuff extracted from ground up almonds. I am ordering 25 pounds of bitter almonds. You must not travel. You must busy yourself, but not in Kassel. I haven't had the courage to tell my wife yet. I can only tell her bit by bit because I know how much it will affect her. Come to us. I expect you at the end of the week." So Wöhler did indeed go to Liebig, and they worked together on bitter almonds, the oil of bitter almonds. So a month later, Wöhler writes and says, "The oil of bitter almonds has come with the books from Paris. I've kept half of it and am herewith sending you the rest. I've already started all kinds of experiments with it without being able to obtain any precise results. It seems to be a hard nut." That's Wöhler for you, right? I'm coming soon to you and will be able to report. So he didn't actually come the next week. He came the next month. So then six weeks later, he writes back and said, here again, he's back home now. Here I am again in my gloomy lonesomeness, not knowing how to thank you for all the love with which you took me in and kept me for so long. How happy I was to work with you from moment to moment. Herewith, I'm sending the paper on the oil of bitter almonds. So this is work that Liebig and Wöhler did together in order to assuage Wöhler's grief at the loss of his wife. So they studied benzaldehyde, which has gone around here, and you've looked at it. What did you notice about it? Where is the bottle now? It's all the way in the back. Did you notice anything about it? Yeah?
We agree that it smells like cherry coke.
That it what?
It smells like cherry coke. We all agree.
Okay. But it's interesting to notice things, right? For example, if you turn it around and look at it, Matt, what do you see if you take this view? Notice anything funny? Screw the top on harder and turn it upside down. Make sure that just briefly and then put it back up. What do you notice? Stuff at the bottom, right? Half of it is solid. Oil of bitter almonds is an oil. What does it say on the front in handwriting? It's dated. When you open a bottle, you date it so you know how long it's been exposed to air or whatever. So this was opened 14 years ago, right? And in that time, it's become solid. Okay? So here's the four. What could they do? What technique could they use to study it? What did they study everything with? Analysis, right? They did the elemental analysis. So they knew it was C7H6O. The oil of bitter almonds. But this stuff that's on the bottom is what was formed when it reacted with oxygen. It's C7H6O2. Right? And they also reacted it with other things they had available, like bromine, and got C7H5OBr, or with chlorine, C7H5OCl, or that reacted that then with potassium iodide, or ammonia, or lead sulfide, and got all these things which they happily analyzed with his nice five-bulb apparatus. Okay? So, this goes towards structure from just composition from just the elemental analysis. How? So what? How could they conclude anything from this or suggest anything from this? Do you see how looking at the comparing these analyses can suggest something? Mike? Right, it's interesting that the sulfur one has a lot more carbon in it. And not only more carbon, more hydrogen, more oxygen. Right? What else do you notice? Sagar?
Chlorine and bromine.
Can't hear very well.
Chlorine and bromine are very similar.
Yeah, that's true. But what do they all have in common? All these things. Hassan? Can't hear. What do they share? Merav? Yeah, they all have C7H5O. Right? So the conclusion was that this C7H5O, and the sulfur one, as Mike pointed out, has two of them. Right? But this is something that persists through reactions. It acts as if it were an element, right? Then trading partners with something else. So you can have the benzoyl, as they called it, radical, right? So there you can have benzoyl with hydrogen, benzoyl with OH, benzoyl with chlorine, with bromine, with two of them with sulfur, benzoyl with NH2, and benzoyl with I. right? So now you can have a sort of dualism, right? That positive negative, right? This can take to organic chemistry what had been so fruitful for inorganic chemistry, where you had electropositive and electronegative things and they would hold together. But now, the difference in organic chemistry is that you have compound radicals, things that you know have several elements in it. So a radical can be the base of more than just an acid. It can give rise to all sorts of other things besides just adding oxygen to it. So the benzoyl radical made possible organic dualism, which is then a big expansion of theory into organic chemistry. So during the 1830s, compound radicals were discovered everywhere in organic chemistry. Liebig discovered the acetyl radical in Germany, and Bunsen discovered the cacodyl radical, which was dimethyl arsenic. In fact, the work on that was done by Kekulé in his kitchen with the arsenic. Berzelius discovered ethyl in Sweden, and in Italy Pyrrha discovered salicyl as a radical that would do this kind of thing, and Dumas in Paris was the most productive of all. He found methyl and cetyl, cinnamyl and ethylene, all these radicals that then you could use dualism to understand change of partners, double decomposition reactions for transformations in organic chemistry. So it wasn't just that urea got rid of vitalism. This whole theory of dualism was now applicable to material that came from living material, from organic, that is organic material. And dualistic radical theory survives today. Right? Where it survives is in our nomenclature. For example, we say ethyl chloride, and when you write ethyl chloride, you put a space in there, because it's the positive and the negative things, right? Two bits come together for ethyl chloride. And the etymology of the ethyl comes from hyla, which is the Greek for wood or matter. So it was the matter of something, that is the radical, the root of something. And from etho, which means to shine. And so that became associated with the sky where there's shiny stuff, and that was limpid, transparent stuff. So colorless liquids were called ethers. And in particular, diethyl ether that we now call was called an ether. So ethyl is the ether, the stuff of ether, right? So ethyl was coined by Liebig in 1834. And methyl comes from methy, wine or spirit, and heli again, which in this case doesn't mean matter, it means wood. So what does it mean, methyl? It's the wood alcohol, right? So ene is the Greek feminine patronymic. It means the daughter of, right? So ene is that. So methyl ene meant the daughter of wood spirits. So wood spirits is methanol, that's wood alcohol. And CH2 was, for Dumas, the root of wood spirits. You add water to it, to CH2, and you get methanol. So methylene was the CH2, right? Of course, it doesn't work exactly that way. But anyhow, that's where the name came from for Dumas in 1835. And then later came methyl, because the first word was methylene, CH2, and then methyl was CH3. And then ethylene came along 12 years later because its relation to ethyl, which had already been named, was the same as the relationship of methylene to methyl. So that's where these names all came during this period, the names we still use. And C3 and C4, you know, are propyl and propylene, and butyl and butylene, the daughter of, right? Now, the butyl comes from C4 was butyric acid, which was named already in 1826 from the Latin word for butter, because it's what makes rancid butter smell bad. Okay, so that's where butyl came from. How about propyl? Where does that name come from? It comes from propionic acid, which was named in 1847, and that comes from protos, which means first, and pion, which means fat. Now, why the first fat? Because these acids, these carboxylic acids, when they're long, are not miscible with water. But when they're short, they're miscible with water. So they become like fats and not miscible with water when you get to when you get to C3. So that's the first acid that's not completely miscible with water. So the propion, the first fatty acid. Okay, so here's a picture of Dumas. So he was the champion of French chemistry. You notice he was born on Bastille Day in 1800. And he would say, you know, chemistry is a French science and has been ever since Lavoisier, even though these guys in Germany were and Sweden, Berzelius, were beginning to take the lead. And it was an insidious system in France because people could hold chairs. You know, there were chairs for professors, but people could simultaneously hold several chairs. So it kept the competition down, right? The same guy would hold the chairs everywhere and everybody would have to do what he said rather than letting a thousand flowers bloom. So he held the chairs simultaneously at the Sorbonne, at the École Polytechnique and the École de Médecine. And he was a persistent opponent of Liebig and Berzelius, except for one brief period. In 1837, Dumas and Liebig appeared to write a joint paper talking about how friendly they were and how they were going to work together. They had met during a trip to England earlier in the year, and when Dumas got back to Paris, he decided to write this thing, but he didn't consult Liebig about it. He just put Liebig's name on it and told how they were all in great agreement. But in fact, Liebig was never party to this. So it was note on the present state of organic chemistry. 60 years have hardly passed since the ever memorable time when this same assembly, he was giving the talk in Paris to the academy. This same assembly heard the first discussions of the fertile chemical doctrine which we owe to the genius of Lavoisier. This short span of time has sufficed to examine fully the most delicate questions of inorganic chemistry, and anyone can easily convince himself that this branch of our knowledge possesses almost everything that it can with the methods of observation available. There barely remain a few cracks here and there to fill in. Right? That's what people always say because they lack imagination, right? That we're there. Okay, but there are a few things we still have to do. What I think we ought to do, and you guys should do it, right? That's the general idea. And remember that this is exactly the kind of thing that Lavoisier had said. He said, you know, we can expect in our own time to see everything be completed. Okay, in a word, so this is a word. How, with the help of the laws of inorganic chemistry, that's dualism, can one explain and classify such varied substances as one obtains from organic bodies, which nearly always are formed only of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, to which elements nitrogen is sometimes joined? So how can you get so many things from so few elements? In a word, right? He'd love to be an orator and talk, right? This was the great and beautiful question of natural philosophy. How can organic chemistry work? A question well designed to excite the highest degree of competition among chemists. For once resolved, the most beautiful triumphs were promised to science. The mysteries of plants, the mysteries of animal life would be unveiled before our eyes. We would seize the key to all the changes of matter, so sudden, so swift, so singular, that occur in animals and plants. More importantly, we would find means of duplicating them in our own laboratories. Well, we are not afraid to say it, and it is not an assertion which we make lightly. This great and beautiful question is today answered. Okay? It only remains to follow through on the consequences which its solution entails. Right? In fact, to produce with three or four elements such varied combinations, more varied perhaps than those which make up the whole inorganic kingdom, nature has chosen a path as simple as it was unexpected. For with elements, she has made compounds which behave in all their properties like elements themselves. What are those? What will we call those? Radicals, right? So radicals are going to be the be-all and end-all of organic theory. And this, we are convinced, is the entire secret of organic chemistry. Now, what would you say he's missing about this, about the secret of organic chemistry? What is it that holds the things together in the radicals? Right? He's just pushing the mystery back one small step. Thus, organic chemistry possesses its own elements, which sometimes play the role of chlorine or oxygen in inorganic chemistry, and sometimes, on the contrary, play the role of metals. What does he mean by that? That sometimes these organic radicals are like chlorine or oxygen, and sometimes they're like metals. Yeah. Yeah, they're positive or negative, electropositive or electronegative, right? Cyanogen, amide, benzoyl, the radicals of ammonia, of aliphatics, of alcohol, and analogous substances, these are the true elements with which inorganic chemistry operates. To discover these radicals, to study them, to characterize them, this has been our daily study for 10 years. Sometimes, nonetheless, our opinions have appeared to differ. And then, with each of us drawn on by the heat of our battle with nature, there arose between us discussions whose liveliness we both regret. Bear in mind that Liebig had nothing to do with writing this. Actually, when we were able to discuss questions which separated us in several friendly meetings, we soon realized that we were in agreement on the principles. We then understood that united we would undertake a task before which either of us in isolation would have recoiled. We will analyze every organic substance to establish reliably what sort of radicals it refers to. So they're not the ones who are going to be doing the analysis. All there, everybody they're the boss of is going to do it. And if they can just get everybody to do this, then we're there. Each of us has, in fact, opened his laboratory to all young men who were motivated by true love of science. Right? They have seen all, understood all. We have worked under their eyes and have had them work under ours in such a way that we are surrounded by young rivals who are the hope of science and whose work will be added to ours and mingle with ours, for it will have been conceived in the same spirit and carried out by the same methods. So if everybody just does what we want them to do, then we're there. Okay? This is not an effort conceived for personal gain or in the interest of narrow vanity. No, far from it. And in a collaboration which is perhaps unheard of in the history of science, this is an undertaking in which we hope to interest every chemist in Europe. So if we can just get every chemist to do what we think they should do, then we've got organic chemistry licked. So it's unimaginative and it's megalomaniacal, maniacal. So, the electronic character of radicals was troublesome for Coulombic dualism. For example, consider the preparation of benzoyl chloride, which you got by reacting the oil of bitter almonds with chlorine. Okay, so H plus Cl minus, fine. And now benzoyl plus Cl minus, that's fine. But what's the problem? Yeah? Yeah, what's this? If H is plus and benzoyl is plus, what's the oil of bitter almonds? So not everything fit in quite as neatly as it might have. And in the 1840s to 1850s, a new theory came up in France called the substitution theory, sometimes called the type theory, sometimes called the unitary theory, to contrast it with dualism. So it's not going to be plus minus. Okay? And it started in at a ball in the Tuileries Palace, which was suddenly, when they lit the candles, filled with choking gas and so on. And Dumas' father-in-law was there and enlisted him to try to figure out what was with these candles. And it turned out that there was chlorine. The gas was HCl that came from the burning these candles. Why was there chlorine in the candles? Because they had been bleached, or the wax had been bleached to make it nice and white. So somehow, the chlorine, which they thought was using just to get rid of the color, was incorporated into the wax. So the question then was, how can organic compounds fix chlorine gas? Chlorine's a gas. How does it get into the molecules is the question. Okay, now there are two ways that we could imagine wax fixing chlorine in terms of what we know about reactivity so far. One is what would make chlorine reactive? Here's a functional group for you. A very low LUMO, sigma star. Okay? Okay, and now what is there now in the wax? What could there be that's a functional group? So normal CHCC bonds are not functional groups. They're our definition of not a functional group. Right? What could there be? Yeah?
It could be a CC double bond.
A CC double bond. For example, to make it very simple, ethylene, which was called the olefiant gas. Olefiant means oil making. That ethylene was called the olefiant gas because it makes an oil, and it makes the oil by reacting with chlorine. Now, so we have the HOMO, which is the pi electron, high HOMO pi electrons here. So we can imagine those reacting, and chloride would leave, right? So we get a new bond between carbon and chlorine, and now there'd be a plus charge if we drew the curved arrow like that because electrons are moving away from the bottom carbon. But now, consider that molecule. Is it going to be reactive? What will make that molecule we just made reactive? Young, you got an idea? What do you see that makes a functional group in that thing? I can't hear very well. Well, there are only three main atoms, right? The CH2 at the top isn't much of a functional group. How about the CH2 plus at the bottom? Does that have any low LUMO or high HOMO? Low LUMO because of the plus charge, and it's an unshared p orbital on the carbon. Okay? Okay, is there any high HOMO around? Young, let's stick with you. What about the chlorine? No, the bond is not unusually high. In fact, it's rather low because chlorine has a high nuclear charge. But where's a high HOMO? Unshared pair. So we can do that. Okay? And that's what you really get. And in fact, both those steps happen at the same time. And let's look at them happening. Okay, so here's the LUMO of the chlorine, the sigma star. Here's the HOMO. So the electrons that are in the HOMO overlap here, right? And we get a sort of a Y bond that holds carbon and that chlorine together. And it puts electrons into this antibonding orbital of chlorine so that chloride goes away with the sigma electrons. Okay? And then it goes the other way too. Here's the HOMO, an unshared pair on chlorine, and it mixes with pi star. So these electrons, all the electrons that were here, also get stabilized by mixing with a LUMO. So it goes both ways. There are two pairs of electrons. Both pairs of electrons hold the chlorine to both carbons. Right? So we make two bonds to carbon if we draw it with straight bonds as we did up here, right? Two pairs of electrons holding the ethylene to the chlorine, and the chloride then goes away. Okay, so we got that. Now, is that thing itself reactive? Anybody got an idea of what might make that reactive? The positive charge is going to make whatever low LUMO you have particularly low. But the charge is not, the charge will make an orbital low, but the charge is not an orbital, right? What's the LUMO? Derek? Mm-hmm. So sigma star CCl will be unusually low because of the nuclear charge of chlorine and because we got a plus charge here. Yeah.
Right?
right? The overlap isn't so good because the angle is short, so the bonds are bent. So that's going to make it, poor overlap is going to do the trick too. So we're going to have a sigma star here that for a number of reasons is reactive, and it'll look something like the sigma star of methyl chloride or methyl fluoride. It'll look something like that. So this then can be reacted with. That's a low LUMO. We're going to need a high HOMO to react it. Where are we going to need that? Where will the reaction happen from? Kathy? From what o'clock will that get attacked? Yeah, you're right. 4 o'clock. Okay. So we need something with a high HOMO at 4 o'clock. Can you think of anything around that's going to be a high HOMO? Not chlorine in what form? Chlorine anion that we generated, right? So we got this chlorine anion that can come over there, right? Then it can attack the unshared pair, the N electrons, right? Can come in and attack, and that will leave, make and break. And we get this thing, which was first discovered in 1795 by Dutch chemists and was called the oil of Dutch chemists, this dichloroethylene. And that was that's the reason that C2H4 is called the olefiant gas, because it gave rise to this particular oil. Okay, so there's one way that organic molecules could fix chlorine, if they had a double bond in them, which some of the fats do. Okay, now, what's the other way? That thing, incidentally, is called addition. So you add two chlorine atoms to the ethylene, right? So it's an addition to an alkene. This is an important reaction that we'll talk a lot more about later. Okay, now, but there's another way. Suppose we don't have a double bond. Could these react with one another? What's the problem if you don't have a double bond? Yeah? Yeah, no high HOMO, no low LUMO. Chlorine's still reactive, but now chlorine can be reactive in a different way too, because that bond isn't very strong. It's only 58 kilocalories per mole. Now that still is strong enough that it's very hard to break. But why did I make it green? Did you ever see chlorine gas? What does it look like? It's green like this. So it absorbs light. What does that do when light gets absorbed? It takes an electron that's in sigma and puts an electron into sigma star. Actually, it's probably an unshared pair electron. But anyhow, it goes into sigma star. And what does that do? It weakens the bond, so you can break it by putting electrons in sigma star with light. So you can take those two electrons and put one on each chlorine. And notice that when you're talking single electrons rather than pairs, you draw arrows that have one barb rather than two, your curved arrows. Okay? So now you have chlorine atoms. But now you can do a reaction with this singly occupied molecular orbital in which you do a reaction very like the one make and break that we did above with a pair of electrons, but now it's single electrons, it's SOMOs that are doing the trick. So again, you make as you break and you get HCl, remember that's what was choking people, and you get methyl radical. But now methyl radical can react with Cl2 in the same way, and you get now methyl chloride. So there's chlorine in the organic stuff, plus a chlorine atom. What's neat about the fact that you get a chlorine atom? That's where you started. Right? So you don't need any more light. This is what's called a chain reaction. So it's hard to get that first chlorine atom, but once you got it, then these reactions turn over and over and over again, and you use it again and again. And we'll talk about those reactions. So you get lots of product from one initial photon. Okay? So this is a completely different kind of reaction. At first, it involves free radicals, not HOMO-LUMO. And second, it's a substitution reaction. You take off, rather than the addition where you add two chlorine atoms, you take off an H and substitute a chlorine for it. Mike?
Why would the SOMO on methyl radical react with the original SOMO of the other one that you haven't attached to it?
This? Why wouldn't this react with that? Well, why wouldn't what react? Why doesn't this react with that?
No, why wouldn't the methyl react with the first chlorine?
Okay, why doesn't this react with this?
Yeah.
Okay, absolutely it could. if it could find it. But remember, they're very, very few radicals. They're very dilute. So that's the key to free radical chain reactions, is to have them be rare. So you encounter normal molecules much more often than you encounter other radicals. And we'll stop now. Says it's what?
Labor's cherry code.
Oh yeah? Good for you.
Sorry, did you get my email?
Yeah, I did.
And would you be able to recommend any?
Yeah, but that's a longer question than what I might have here.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. And when we put this part of the reaction up, it's, I guess, intermediate here, you said that this was a little limo of an unshared p orbital. Why wouldn't that hybridize?